Welcome to Let's Talk Science with Irene Moon. Today our guest is evolutionary biologist Jerry Holker from North Carolina State University. This is part two in our exploration of evolution and the human ability to conceptualize long periods of Earth history. WELCOME.
Perfect.
Excellent.
Perfect. Well, for this moment of time, we're going to be talking with... So how do you pronounce your name?
Jerry Holser.
Jerry Holser. He's an evolutionary biologist. Can I call you that?
Please do so.
From North Carolina State University at the present time, working with ants and with bark
and
beetles.
All kinds of creatures that live under tree bark.
What other kind of creatures live under tree bark?
There are creatures from almost all animal and organism of phyla, as we call them.
What is a phyla?
Phylum is the largest, the grandest division of a life.
So if you walked into a castle, the front room would be the phyla?
The grandest division of life has three categories, which is the bacteria.
Right.
The eukaryotes, which is all of us, and fungi and plants and anything that we can see.
Right.
And the archaea, which are barely present in our regular lives, but they are in rocks. They live in hot springs. They live in places where the life as we know it mostly...
I know some people that have had the archaea bacteria taken out of their lives.
Indeed, they live in our mouth and on our skin. There are several strains. I'm sure that's not what you meant, but there are very few of them living in our nearest neighborhood.
Is that the same thing as botulism?
It's completely different.
Oh.
Botulism is from a very different phylum.
Oh.
Botulism is from a bacterium, Clostridium botulinum, that produces the compound that causes botulism.
Which is like in humans, it turns out to be like paralysis and stuff.
Indeed, in almost all animals that we know that where botulism occurs.
So I met this guy at a party one time and he told me that he got botulism from his mom's like fake burger meat that she made out of soybeans one time, and he was in a coma for 3 months. Do you think that could be a true story, or was he just spinning a yarn?
You can definitely get botulism from your mom's fake meat product, especially if you keep it without oxygen for a while.
Oh, this, like canning. Bad canning.
Very bad canning. If you don't can it right, then bacteria grow, eat up all the oxygen, and the nasty ones grow that can live without oxygen, that essentially ferment the meat. And you don't want that. That's bad for your belly. So
yeah.
It's possible, but it's not possible that he was in coma for 3 months. Well, it's possible, but I don't believe it.
He also had a beard, which I thought made him really suspicious about some other things.
Including that I shaved.
Okay, so this is really not why we're here, but Jerry, I want to ask you a couple of questions about some things that I find really interesting personally, but it has to do with the life on the planet and where we've come from and where we're going, sort of evolutionarily speaking, but the progress, well, progress is a really loaded word. I don't want to use the word progress, but about how we as human beings in our very short lifetime, you know, I mean, at most 70, 80, 90 years, and we try to conceptualize evolution or the development of life through natural selection or life through processes, which comes through very slow developmental time, I think, over millions of years. And I think to myself that in my 39 years now of existence, if I can conceptualize a million years, I fall very short of actually trying to perfectly perceive of how long it possibly takes for one thing to evolve slowly through time to another. And I guess what I really want to ask you, as an evolutionary biologist yourself, is how do you perceive... We're not questioning the process of evolution here. We're questioning the perception of time that has to do from millions of years ago, from the beginning of a trilobite, and that you as a biologist, how do you perceive, or do you ignore the fact that you cannot actually conceptualize millions of years of time?
That is absolutely correct. I have no doubts that human brains are just not made for this kind of perception. We have a clock in our brain. We might even have several kinds of clock for different purposes, but none of them is even remotely suitable to measure the time that evolution needs or that evolution happens in. And you can visualize this fairly interestingly when, for example, draw yourself a little line. Draw yourself a little line where the distance between your lifetime and that of, and pick your favorite historical figure.
Henry VIII
is great.
1675.
Let's pick somebody from the ancient Egypt, for example. Cleopatra, how about that?
Sure. But you know what? I don't even know when that is.
Right. It's been a long time. It's been a few thousand years. I mean, imagine 100 years. You can do that. We are kind of made for the about 100 year of a perception. Now, imagine Cleopatra. You know, if it's 4,000 years, it's not. It was something more than 2,000. But something more than 2,000 years, that's a long time. And it's so long that the human perception of the world has changed. Our combined consciousness, the consciousness of humanity, has changed completely.
So at least 200 lifetimes since then.
I think, biologists measure human generations by about 25 years, because that's when the average childbearing age happens in most original cultures. And so...
Unless you're a yuppie.
Indeed. Then you don't get any sometimes. But divide 2,500 years by 25 and you'll get the number of biological generations of humans. It's a lot. A lot of people have been born, married, had children, lived, made money, ate, died, had life, and they're gone. Thousands of them. So we are only kind of... our brains are vaguely able to grasp this dimension of time. Now, you know how long it's been since humans started, let's say since humans left Africa? It was about 120,000 years. And now imagine that. You know, imagine the span between now and Cleopatra. We are barely able to stick that into our brains.
Okay.
Now imagine the first people using a tool in Africa.
So, the question that I'm trying to get at is, you as an evolutionary biologist, that's exactly the dilemma. I feel like that is actually much of the inability to conceptualize evolution has to do with the fact that human beings cannot conceptualize past their own worthwhile. So they can't conceptualize past their children and grandchildren and grand-grandchildren, much less 1,000 years ago, much less 120,000 years ago, much less towards the beginning of time.
Yes, I agree. And now here's another interesting phenomenon. And I started this with draw yourself a line. And let's say the time between you and Cleopatra would be 1 centimeter. And now draw that line to when the humans left Africa, about 120,000 years ago. That would be about something more than a meter. Now, if you continue diving into the past, you go past the people who lived in Africa. Turns out that you would still have to go about 2 million years back to see the very first hominid, the first homo-like person in Africa. 2 million years. That's many, many, many more times. And you are still drawing a line. Now it would be a few meters long. And now if you draw this line towards, let's say, when the dinosaurs all went out, because of the impact of asteroid, and all the mammals started to rule the Earth. That was about 64 million years ago. This line would go through your neighbor's house and to the neighbor, to the block next door. And now if you draw that line to the beginning of life, for example, you know, we are still talking about life that we know, about the large animals and plants. But if you actually draw this line all the way back to when the first bacteria popped up and started to eat sulfur and iron around themselves, there was still no oxygen. This line would be so incredibly long that you would barely, you might, oh, now I'm gonna make it up though. I don't know how much, you know, these things are.
It would be from here to like in Raleigh, North Carolina, all the way to Newcastle, England or something like that. Exactly. I mean, that's a long way.
So my point is that we are barely able to conceive or perceive the time that it took humanity to go from Egypt to now. But then the reality is that evolution had absolutely imperceptibly vast time for itself.
So does this mean that time doesn't matter to you?
Well, time matters enormously. Evolution and essentially biology can only be really understood if you combine the basic building blocks of life and time.
What are the basic building blocks of life?
The organic compounds such as
Carbon, nitrogen, oxygen,
exactly, sulfur, and the basic blocks of life. And you provide fairly stable atmosphere, fairly stable conditions, and
some
lots
heat.
Of time. But not much heat, not much variation.
You don't cook it?
You certainly don't cook it. Sometimes you can cook it, but that doesn't...
Denatures it if you cook it.
That is the right word. It happened several times during the evolution that most nature was denatured by various events. That only shows you how actually fragile this life is here, that just a little whimsical event in the grand scheme of the universe wiped out almost, I would say, over 90% of time of life during the Permian era, for example. It was a major, major extinction where almost all life went out. But it recovered.
So me as just a person, and I want to experience evolution. If I wanted, because evolution sounds to me like it's a process that takes a lot of time, more time than any human being could possibly imagine. I mean, I see an old building from the 1600s, and I can see the erosion and imagine that it's old, but I can't really imagine how old it could be. Or I see a fossil and I don't really think in blocks of time past 100s. So if someone wanted to recognize the evolutionary process now, is it possible?
It's actually fairly easy. There are a number of examples. Obviously, evolution is happening now. As we speak, it's happening in the human species, it's happening in the whole life. But it usually is slower than human perception. So what we want to do is we want to go to the organisms that evolve fast, which means they're very small and they have a really fast reproductive rate, such as bacteria. And there's a number of examples of bacteria living in the lab in someone's petri dish, clearly showing signs of very nice evolution. There is a lab, for example, at Michigan State University, where the director, Richard Lenski, had this brilliant idea a few decades ago. He would start two different colonies of E. coli, the bacterial lab rat, as we know it, the most commonly studied bacterium.
What does the E stand for?
It's Escherichia.
Escherichia.
The genus Escherichia.
Was it named after Escher?
I believe it was Mr. Escherich.
Oh.
I didn't know him.
Not the artist, Escher. Sorry. Exactly.
And
pipe dreams.
He started two different colonies, one living in the nice conditions, one living in bad conditions. And he tracked them. He occasionally sampled those. He took a few of those bacterial cells, put them in a freezer every year or so. So now, what he sees is that the two bacterial communities differ dramatically. Their genes, their genomes, their gene content, everything adapted through this short evolution to the conditions in which they live, have been forced to live in their little prisons. And that's because this very simple yet amazingly productive process called natural selection, simply the bacteria that were able to live, that were able to be more hungry or live off of this weird sugar rather than regular sugar, there were more of them in the next generation. And that's how they adapted, and the ones that originally had some what you would call mistakes or mutations in their genomes that happened to be handy for metabolizing this weird sugar, they proliferated better in these strange conditions. And now Rich Lenski has this phenomenal library of evolutionary steps, and he and his colleagues and his students are now sampling these frozen samples, and they are taking the bacteria out and are looking at the proteins, which are molecules in all of us as well as in bacteria, that actually make the life happen. They are looking at the DNA or the genetic information in the bacteria and are looking at the incremental mutations or the different genes that the bacteria swapped among each other that allowed for this evolution. This is one of the, I would say, most brilliant examples of a fast evolution in the making that we can see with our own eyes on our lab bench. But there are many others, even in our regular lives. There are examples of bacteria adapting, evolving resistance to antibiotics. There are examples of insects. Essentially, every major insect pest species has evolved already the capability to resist or survive or evade almost all standard traditional pesticides or insecticides. So evolution is present, happy and healthy, everywhere around us, wherever there's a substantial selection pressure.
Yeah, that's interesting because I know that in particular where there's heavy metal spills, plants tend to either adapt or die in those situations. And in some areas where there's, unfortunately, heavy metal spills, the same species of plant will die off. And in other areas, the species of plant will thrive.
Indeed, that's because of either beneficial mutations that allow the plant to survive, but very often it's also because of a spread of genes for resistance between and among populations. It actually turns out that a lot of evolution happens by choosing from the natural selection, choosing various features from the redundant vast amounts of genes that most organisms have in them. We have multiple copies.
Choice is a really weird word to use because nobody's choosing anything.
Right.
So, but it's a kind of a forced reconciliation with the fact that there are heavy metals and you either metabolize or you die.
Indeed.
Which I guess sometimes choices are that way too. But yeah. Yeah.
And it also points out the fact that there's a lot of redundancy in life.
Life on this planet is like the branches of a tree.
Yes.
Right? It's the in branches of the tree, and we're just the leaves hanging out on the end of the tree. Right? So I don't believe that most people really understand the concept of the common ancestor. So, and I'm not sure that I understand the concept of the common ancestor, honestly, to tell you the truth. But so we're all branches on a tree. And so it's not necessarily that we are related to something that's, you know, existing right now an extant species. But that there's evidence that shows that us and other extant species, species that also live now, at one time evolutionarily had a common ancestor. And that this tree of life can be traced back further and further and further and further to where there was one spark of life that made everything eventually. But that is so permutated through time and through extinction and through duplication and through gene transfer and through all of this stuff that there's really no way to, you know, attain that, except that we share a lot of the same genetic code with much of all the rest of life, including bacteria, Drosophila, fruit flies, everything else. So I guess that's the one thing I wanted to, and I just sort of kept talking about it, but is that we are only the tips of these little branches that exist.
That is absolutely correct. I would say a better way to visualize it may be to imagine our very, very, very distant ancestors as a soup of life, rather than as a one straggling bacterium that then gave rise to everything that came after that. It was really a soup of life bubbling happily on the shores of the ancient oxygenless oceans. What happened then is, again, easy to visualize as, just like you said, as a tree. But now you really have to go back to where the tree started as a little sapling. And now you go to the forest and you see a whole bunch of different saplings, and they're all kind of small, inconspicuous. At that point of time, you have no way of predicting which one of them will go out, which one of them will die. It's going to be 99% of them. They all look alike, but only one of them will grow and branch out and will bear all these leaves that we can imagine as species. And it's the same. People are somehow imagining that all this amazing life was somehow contained in that first ancestor, the magical creature. That's certainly not the case. It was some kind of a bacterium, or if we go a little bit farther, it was some kind of a tadpole in the mud, stuck in the mud probably, somewhere in the Silurian puddle. At that moment, you would have no idea that anything will come out of it. And it's really the haphazard, unpredictable nature of organic evolution,
because
and the vast amounts of time.
Evolution doesn't necessarily mean improvement, does it?
Improvement, it depends on what kind of improvement you mean. There has certainly been a vast amount of improvement over the past few million years in any imaginable sense. There is more complexity now than there was. Many species are much more complex than they were before. There are more of those species. There are many, many more interactions between species. There are more niches filled. If you'd go back...
But can we say that about before any major extinction, you know, like...
So I would say that the history of life is plagued with problems and with extinctions. But the amazing feature of life is that it tends to diversify. And because of the natural selection, because of the diversification, because of the vast amounts of times it had, and because of its ability to diversify and fill in niches, and then diversify even further, life as a whole has a certain tendency to become more complex overall. And that it doesn't necessarily mean that all species are becoming more amazing, complicated, whatnot. Certainly not. There are some masters of survival that are super simple. There are very simple plants, animals that are here with us because they mastered certain simplicity and the way of survival with the minimum.
So generalists, in a way, are very complex because they are very good at being generalists.
Exactly. Generalists, such as insects that can eat lots of kind of plants, that's not a coincidence. That's because they have evolved the ability to fight with defense chemicals of all these plants. So generalists often are really
specialists.
A product of indeed, specialists do many different sources, niches, and whatnot. They're products of very complex evolution. Same with scavengers, you would think. Scavengers often have a very, very complex immune system and ability to degrade and utilize and use nutrients that other animals refused.
So I heard that vultures, I don't know the scientific name, but like turkey vultures or black vultures and stuff, that they have, they eat, like if you go to the dump out here, they're eating stuff out of the dump, they eat roadkill, full of festering bacteria. But their stomachs, from what I heard, is that it's more acidic than the normal stomach of a normal thing. So if they eat something rancid that would make the normal person, like if I went to go eat a roadkill, it would make me sick. But the vulture's just fine.
You would probably get botulism from that roadkill. But that is absolutely true. Vultures have so acidic.
So if a vulture pukes on you, it's going to hurt?
It's actually their defense mechanism.
Wow.
If you bother a vulture, it's going to spit at you.
I'm not going to bother a vulture, but yeah.
It's called a projectile vomiting, and that's their defense mechanism, and they're screeching and vomiting their stomach juices at that invader, which, for example, if that invader happens to be a person, seriously burns that person's skin.
Wow. That actually seems like a dare.
Right. Don't do that.
Yeah, no, I won't do that. I won't do that. But
pester vultures.
Yeah, if I ever wanted, to, I don't know, dare somebody to go mess with the vulture. There we go. The I guess my last thing that I wanted some commenting on is about all of these species that are in the world today and the branches of the tree of life and this amazing complexity that we have presently on the planet. And it is the present pinnacle of evolution because we now exist at the pinnacle, even though natural selection and the processes of evolution are happening now as we speak under our feet, even to us, we are involved in the processes of evolution.
Absolutely.
Without knowing it or not knowing it, that we are.
Well, humans are totally in the boiling pot of evolution. Absolutely. There are many different evolutionary processes happening to us. I will mention two, the maybe most obvious. One is that, notice what happened to people over the last 2 million years, or let's say over the last 120,000 years ever since we left Africa. We diversified into various different tribes, races. We've attained various ecological capabilities suited to the particular environment where those kinds of peoples lived. If you lived in a rainforest, your ancestors lived in the rainforest. Your ancestors likely had adaptations to living in the rainforest much better than adaptations of people who lived over the Arctic Circle or people who lived on a very, very high mountains. We know now, scientists now know very, very well adaptations that are needed for survival in high mountains, for example, or above the Arctic Circle. Many other. There are, for example, a human coevolution with organisms, with other organisms, is also a very active phenomenon, very active process,
like
right now.
The cat ladies and toxoplasmosis.
Exactly. Well, our coevolution with microbes is inevitably happening right now. But again, it's not necessarily, not all. I was going to finish the story that people have evolved to fill in various niches that existed before we started to homogenize this planet. And notice what happened during the last, let's say, 100 years. After we homogenized the planet, people started homogenizing themselves. Our species now is overall less variable than it was before because we have essentially every single person now has some genes from very many other races that for most of our evolutionary time were separated reproductively. So now we are homogenizing our species, and that's clearly an evolutionary phenomenon. The other kind of evolution that's happening now, and again, this is not necessarily the progression of evolution that people often imagine. This is not going towards some very fine-tuned adaptation. This is simply a response of a species to a new environment, which in this case happens to be a planet interconnected with airplanes and highways, and a common language. And there are a number of other adaptations that are happening to us, or you would say to our species, even though adaptations don't necessarily happen to an individual person, which is our symbiosis with many other organisms. You know, there are a number of people who have genes to be that allow them to digest milk as adults, for example. No other mammal does that. It's unique to those humans who co-evolved with cows. And that's a very, very recent evolutionary event that happened at about probably two or three times independently in the world, in places where people domesticated cows. And you can't even begin to imagine the evolution that's now happening to accommodate all the new diseases that are now being spread around the world, or have been during the last 500 years after people invented long-range dispersal by various modes of transportation.
Let's list them. Flu, plague, typhoid, syphilis, tuberculosis,
smallpox,
AIDS.
Any number of
polio,
diseases.
Polio.
Indeed.
Mumps, measles, tuberculosis.
And you notice what happens. People who have not been facing those diseases in their own previous evolution have not had the chance to evolve defense mechanisms.
Like smallpox
and the Native Americans. And they're no longer with us. Those members of their communities or of their lineage, evolutionary lineage, are no longer with us. And this is an evolution by natural selection, acting upon us through diseases. It's happening all the time. A lot of people are still dying, for example, because of malaria, dengue, and so forth, dengue fever. But there are number of genes, number of adaptations that the human genome as a whole has, but they're not widespread throughout the whole population. Only some people have those adaptations to survive those diseases, and naturally, they're spreading. Again, evolution in the making. In humans.
Let's talk about human beings as being the major predator. Because human beings, even though some of us are vegetarian, it sort of doesn't matter if you're vegetarian or not. As we exist on this planet, we are the planet's major predators. If there's a bug on the ground, we can step on it. If there is a rat, we poison it. If there's something in the garden, we spray it. Very rarely are we not the major predator if we're competing in an area. At most, if we're camping, there are black or brown bears, or there may very well be sharks if we're swimming in the ocean. But the chances are much more likely to get hit by lightning than attacked by a shark, unless you're trying to swim with a whole bunch of them or something like that.
Well, compare the number of people dying out of shark attack and compare that to the number of sharks dying in people's nets.
That's right. So human beings are by far, even though nature does definitely take its toll on humans through earthquakes, natural disasters, and whatnot, undoubtedly throughout the world, human beings as a whole are the Earth's major predators.
We're incredibly successful and very sophisticated predators. For many reasons, the number one is our collaboration. Number two is our ability to make tools. It's worth pointing out that the major predator of people are people themselves. That the obviously number one source of deaths by other organisms other than diseases are
it's
people
war.
Again.
It's people.
Exactly. And this topic really, really makes me... The topic of people as predators makes me very sad and almost nostalgic, because what it, the images that it brings to me are those of the nature around us before it was impacted by the voracious first tribes of people, the hunters. Imagine, for example, here where we are sitting in Raleigh, North Carolina, we can dig out fairly frequently from beneath our feet, from when people are building garages and highways, we dig out mastodon bones. We dig out large, giant sloths. There are three different elephants living here. There was the mastodon, there was the Columbia mammoth, there was the woolly mammoth. It was, it's not clear when the last ones died off, but they were very happy around here, definitely 40,000 years ago.
So when people were here?
Absolutely.
Or
they overlap.
Proto-people, or however you want to say it.
I wouldn't call them proto-people.
These They're people-people.
These were extremely
people.
Skilled and extremely swiftly moving troops of hunters. The first culture of people that we know inhabited North America were the Clovis hunters. And we are still finding very commonly the fancy large Clovis spear points, for example. These are very large, very finely manufactured spear points. That's also pretty much the only thing that's left after these people, with the exception of a few other shreds. That points out the fact that they really were extremely focused on hunting. And now imagine why not? When they appeared on the face of North America, the landscape was dotted by megafauna. There were large mammals, large birds, large everything in incredible numbers everywhere. And it's not quite known why within just a few thousand years all this incredibly diverse life, the megafauna, why it all went away.
But there's a good speculation.
There's a good speculation that people helped it a lot. You know, there might be a reason why turtles survived, but the saber-toothed tiger didn't. It's because people really like the big mammals, like to eat them. And we are really efficient at especially killing mammals that are not adapted to people hunting. So imagine the hunters not only showed up here in North America where there were a lot of mammals, but they also were absolutely naive.
Well, it's the same thing as when mammals showed up in New Zealand and all the flightless birds. Humans are not. All of a sudden, there were these things that were existed on the island, because New Zealand is really just a very large island, that the birds weren't adapted to dealing with. And
this is a collection of crushing stories. Every tropical island that I know of used to have a fascinating assemblage of animals and plants, often large ones, ones that have never been repeated anywhere else. And within a few years or a few decades after people or the Westerners discovered those islands, or the Polynesians in the case of Polynesia, all these fascinating animals were gone.
So the one thing that humankind has that perhaps my feline does not have when she kills a bird is that humankind does have a consciousness at some level. We are conscious at least a little of our actions, even though it's arguably that we are fairly unconscious of a lot of our actions in life. But we are conscious of our actions, and we have the ability to perceive the impact of our actions on the planet and to the planet's leaves, to this biodiversity that exists on the planet. And there's no doubt that human beings will be the major predators on the planet for a long time to come, at least within my lifetime and multiple lifetimes after me. After that, it may or may not be as clear. But in the given lifetime, we are conscious of our own destruction.
That is absolutely correct. And this is another interesting story, which essentially points out the fact that natural selection is what rules evolution, including evolution of humans, not our conscious decisions. And here's why. Because natural selection really operates on the level of an individual. If you do something so that you get better off than your neighbor, you will have a higher chance to have more sibling, more progeny. Your neighbor doesn't. Now, if you exhaust some supply of some local rare resource, it's going to screw up almost everybody except for you. And you're going to probably be the winner in the long run. And this is happening everywhere in the world, that the natural selection operating on the level of individual really does favor and actually makes people almost oblivious of the fact that organizing this consciousness into some form of an effort to save us and the planet as a whole is really dwarfed by the individual urges that every single one of us has.
And you know, it ends up as excuses.
Absolutely.
You know, well, I really needed to do that because, you know, I can't recycle this because I have to go to my job every day. Or, well, they need to have a new pair of shoes and the cheapest ones come from, you know, plastics that are made in some far across place that costs lots of fossil fuels and stuff like that. So there's, you know, those urges of natural selection come into a lot of forms of excuses.
Absolutely. And so I'm fairly convinced, I mean, I think it's unquestionable that it's really natural selection that is now operating on humans, on the planet, and will in the future. Sadly, it's operating in ways and producing patterns that are really hard to talk about, that are often very personal, and are creating the world that we not always like.
So natural selection, as far as, I mean, it was touched on earlier, but it's not always progress. Natural, in the sense that we think of progress as humankind is going to something, a better place. Progress is moving to a better place. But natural selection, it's progressing forward, but it potentially could be going to a darker place in the short term.
Absolutely, no question. It's always benefiting people. It's always benefiting individuals of whatever species that can leave more progeny on the surface of the earth.
But eventually and could whether, lead to extinction.
Absolutely. Whether this is a long-term sustainable production of progeny has really no bearing on the individual's...
It's just if you get your genes
exactly
to that next generation.
And notice, here's an analogy, for example. If you put some bacteria into a drop of sugar water, they will reproduce like crazy and eat the sugar as fast as possible because every single individual needs, has the instinct, really has the machinery, the genetic and enzymatic machinery to eat as much as they can so that they outnumber the others and they leave more progeny, more spores for the time when the drop goes away, evaporates. Humans have never operated in any different manner than bacteria because it's always more beneficial to each individual to act so that that individual wins, regardless of what the future brings. So in a sense, it's the exact same process, natural selection functioning on the level of individual, that governs human and bacterial societies.
So as a final question, and going back to the perception of change, do you feel like in your lifetime, as a young adult, that the world that you live in now, is it going to proceed and move forward in a very rapid pace? Or will the procedure be fairly slow? I know my father, for example, remembers places without indoor plumbing. And he remembers, civilization, like the progress of civilization a lot. He remembers places without indoor plumbing, and he remembers whole towns with, you know, using candles as lighting. And things of that sort, where people grew their own food and, you know, blah, 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 you know, walk 2 miles in the snow to go to school or whatever. But there was definitely, you know, old Ford cars, and there wasn't the highways, and all these two lanes ended up four lanes and all of this other stuff. So there's all this progress, you know, on that level of civilization through time. And in your lifetime, do you imagine the progression of humanity with the level of population that we have and all of these other things? Do you imagine What is it going to be like in 50 years?
I would divide the future evolution into two categories now, which is the cultural evolution and the actual natural evolution. And the cultural one, I'm fairly certain, will be speeding up because complexity breeds complexity, and fast complexity breeds even faster complexity. There's no question that the more computers we have, the more computers will run our lives, and overall, it's making all us all more efficient in whatever we do. The natural evolution, on the other hand, does not speed up or slow down. It's always measured by the steady, regular rhythm of human generations. Whatever gets recorded in our genes and gets passed on, that's the rhythm and tempo of evolution. So it's not going to speed up or slow down. What will probably happen is that new environments, new social and natural environments, and the new ability to breed with whoever you want versus breed with only the ones who you grew up among will breed new patterns into where the humankind is heading and how mixed up it is and how fragmented it is. It's very hard to predict any of that, really.
And you never know what's going to happen. I mean, it could be that at some point, natural selection points that if you want your generations to continue, human survival will exist only if the planet exists or other things exist as well. I don't know. There was this great story recently about polar bears. I mean, not to talk about polar bears, things are getting heavy, but so, you know, all the ice caps are melting. Everybody's like real worried about the polar bears, and they still are worried about the polar bears, and they should be worried about the polar bears. Polar bears are in, you know, they're kind of in dire straits. You know,
imagine
what I mean?
The world without polar bears.
Yeah,
it's a major loss of a major flagship species.
It's a white bear. Yeah, it's real serious. But the thing is about these polar bears was like, oh man, if they don't have their seal fields to hunt, these polar bears are toast. They're gone. And what they found out is that polar bears are actually a lot more adaptive than you would imagine. That the polar bear suddenly decided to go to shore and eat all the seagulls and the penguins and other things. There's no penguins there, sorry.
Nothing.
Right. Other things on the shore, including the small children and stuff like that, instead of dying out as themselves. Because the object was for them to survive. So they are adapting to other eating environments besides what they were most used to. Not all animals, of course, have that kind of flexibility. Some of them are a lot more specialized. But it is to say that we don't know. You
that
know, we can hypothesize about things, but
that
we don't actually know.
The troubling aspect here is that what the polar bears are doing are just cultural evolution. They're figuring out new things, but their genetic pool, their genetic basis, has not changed a bit towards any better. It's shrinking, and if a species is super smart, but has an extremely limited genetic variation, which is the case of essentially every single species of large carnivores these days, it's in trouble because genetic variation is critically important
for adaptation.
Adaptation and for just maintenance of bear health. We need various alleles to complement for the detrimental alleles that all species are riddled with. So, and the other problem with polar bears is that they might be adapting to new resources. But the problem is that eventually, every time they adapt to something else, it's more likely that they will be competing with people.
And yeah, it's because it's just more and more people all the time.
Exactly. It's the competition that brings species to extinction.
And eventually, there's no level of adaptation that they can do that will stop a gunshot.
The reality is that humans are, if you plot animals on a chart where on one axis there's going to be their weight, the body size, and on the other scale, on the other axis there's going to be their abundance on the planet Earth, you will get a fairly nice line pointing out that the bigger an animal, the fewer there usually are, simply because of the physical nature of feeding, that there just isn't that much food, that much nutrients for a regularly foraging organism. Now, humans are way off this chart. much, much farther from this nice line than any other organism, because we can conquer and utilize so many different niches.
And we like sausages. I mean, I like sausages.
And sausages are a major reason why we, very big, warm-blooded, very actively metabolizing organisms, are so abundant. We can really squeeze the planet so much more efficiently than any other species out there. And that's the primary reason why the planet is in trouble. It's not necessarily our insidious politicking against it. It's just the numbers.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that every topic with a conversation with an evolutionary biologist goes to the evolutionary disaster that is the planet at the moment. But it does tend to go that way. I was just going to mention something very briefly, that it's not only the large organisms, but because of the use of pesticides that we... Here we go. Tirade. Because of the use of pesticides that we tend to spray willy-nilly on everything in all of our food crops, it's pretty well known that even our insect diversity is dramatically reducing. And a lot of the major entomologists at worldwide collections, they're basically just trying to preserve the world's biodiversity at this moment by putting them in the collections and preserving them for the future, because they're being wiped off the planet before people even realize what they are or what they're related to. And all of those leaves are falling off pretty quickly. And humans are definitely the cause of that, because there's, for one cause, if not many, there's just so many of us that, and we require a lot of resources, of the planet's resources. And
can I end on a happy note?
Can you please? Because that got really depressing.
I'll try to end on a happy note, because
I'm really bummed out now, and I knew this was going to happen. And it was funny, because I really, my only idea was to talk about fast or slow time,
yes.
And it ended up being that the planet and we're all in this grave at the same time together.
Sadly,
which is probably
heading there, but you know, there's hope, and we can learn from the alligators that we've discussed a little while ago. Alligators are an excellent example of the fact that faster doesn't always mean better. If you're a really fast living animal, it doesn't always mean that you get to the end goal of survival more reliably. Or even better than alligators, turtles.
I thought turtles were slow.
Exactly. No, turtles are very slow, as you would guess. But that's to their advantage.
Oh.
Sometimes it's so much better to stand back and wait out whatever's happening. Sometimes it's so much better to slow down your metabolism and let the fast ones die. Let the fast ones reproduce and crash their populations and get slammed by...
Like the rabbit.
Like the rabbit, the rat,
turtle,
the lemming,
hair.
Anything. And I think there's a good lesson for people. I think that's the hope for people. I think what we are seeing is that regardless of all this carnage done to the planet, what we are seeing is that if you step back a little bit as an individual, you, as the individual, will gain an evolutionary advantage, in this case mostly, well, actually both the cultural and the natural evolution. If you step back, slow down, and think about what you're doing, focus on your actions in this world, are more careful and choosy, it turns out that people who can focus and think and invest in their long-term benefits are really better off, even in this very, very fast living society, in this very fast changing planet. And I think this is a very big potential for hope here, that the natural selection will favor people who can stop and think again and think about, what are we going to do with us, with ourselves? And maybe get together with like-minded folks. And maybe weigh down the craziness and figure out something better.
So, on a last note, not that you believe in reincarnation, but if you were to be reincarnated and come back as some creature, what would it be?
Wait a minute. Can I choose people again? I would like to be human. Because I don't think any, even the smartest animal can really wake up, see the sunrise, and be so freaking happy.
That's pretty iterative. Yeah, that's all right. Okay, I was going to say a turtle, but...
Turtle is a good one. Yeah, I agree.
I like the idea of being a hopeful. Turtle.
I would say some kind of an insect pest because they're really successful. But the bummer is that they live about 2 months.